The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Political memoirs are traditionally written by men and read by other men hoping to follow in their footsteps. As a young woman aspiring to a career in politics, Alyssa Mastromonaco looked up to a lot of these men. Ambitious, hardworking people who'd forged a path from political campaigns all the way to the White House. After dedicating herself to a few politicians with familiar names, Senator Bernie Sanders and then-Senator John Kerry, Alyssa worked her way up through the Obama White House to a position just a few feet from the Oval Office. She became the youngest woman to hold the title of Deputy Chief of Staff to the President of the United States. Now she's sharing her story, along with her advice to young women setting out on a career in the demanding world of politics. Alyssa Mastromonaco is the author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Alyssa, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, thank you so much for having me.
You were initially a French major, minoring in Japanese at the University of Vermont. So how did you get into politics?
So when I was up at school in Burlington, I wanted to stay the summer and hang out with the kids. And my parents said, not without a job. And so I actually applied to be an intern for Bernie Sanders, and I wrote a lovely cover letter, and they picked me. And within 3 weeks of my internship, so I basically answered the phones and I, you know, faxed things and cut clips out of newspapers because this is all pre-internet. And I fell so in love with it that I changed my major to political science 2 months later.
So you were hooked.
It was everything. I was in the Burlington Congressional Office during the day. I volunteered on the campaign at night. And then at the end of the summer, they invited me back to be in their Washington office the next summer.
So you were in Washington. And then you worked later on John Kerry's presidential campaign. This is 2004 as director of scheduling, right?
I did. Well, I actually got a job. I had been working in New York City for a while because I didn't get any political jobs when I graduated college. And a girlfriend of mine had moved to Boston, and I saw John Kerry give a speech on TV, and I was like, what am I doing? I should get back in this. I can't give up. And so I wrote what I like to call my Jerry Maguire manifesto about, like, why they had to take me, and I actually applied to be an intern, and I was going to intern again and just work another job to pay the bills, and they actually hired me as a staff assistant. And so I worked for John Kerry for about 2 years, and then he was going to move me down to his D.C. office. And about 2 weeks before I was going to start, 9/11 happened. And almost all political action committees and fundraising committees suspended all activity. So I was out of a job. And I got a couple odd jobs in between. But then when he decided to run for president in December of 2002, he called me back.
And you were all in as director of scheduling. But of course, he did not win. This was a huge and your first major political disappointment. What did you learn from that experience?
First, I learned you should always save money as much as you can because you never know when you're going to be unemployed. And then I think for the first time, you know, at a young age, which I'm glad about because I think we're more resilient when we're young, I learned that politics is a pendulum. You know, it swings back and forth, and there's always a winner and there's always a loser, and you're never always going to be the winner. So I think it was a good lesson in resilience.
So after Kerry's loss, you were looking for work again. How did you get on Senator Obama's team?
So this actually goes to sort of the awesomeness of what was, before we called it social media, but it was an AOL instant message from Robert Gibbs, who had left the Kerry campaign to go sort of help run Obama's Senate race in Illinois. And Gibbs sent me an IM when I was busy shutting down the Kerry campaign, and he said, hey, do you need work? I said, I do. And about 2 weeks later, I was meeting with Pete Rouse, who had signed on to be Obama's chief of staff and is sort of like the mayor of Capitol Hill. And then I met with Obama.
You got a good picker, Alyssa, don't you? I mean, Bernie Sanders, John Kerry, Senator Obama. Did you have a sense that this man was going to run for president in those early days?
No, and it's so interesting because when Bernie, you know, I was telling everybody this year that, or you know, 2015, that I really believed Bernie would catch fire. Like, I really did. I think he's an excellent orator and a huge presence. And it's kind of also part of the lesson in the book. You know, I picked Bernie, I picked John Kerry, I went with Barack Obama. I really think that if you want to be successful, you have to pick people to work for that you truly believe in. And the end goal needs to be engaged. It can't be like you try to do these all these machinations to figure out how to get to the White House, because I think that's where you lose your way. And if I were 17 and said all I care about is working in the White House, I probably wouldn't have made the right decisions and would never have ended up there.
Interesting, too, because you went from working on this winning presidential campaign to working on the presidential transition team. Yep. But there was no guarantee of securing a job at the White House. That was a little surprising to me. First, how'd you make it happen?
How did I get my job?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm lovely, obviously.
Clearly.
I think that, you know, I think the thing that I benefited from and that so many of us did is that I did my job as well as I could on the campaign. And that was to be the director of scheduling in advance. And I didn't sort of like try to veer. I swam in my own lane. And I think by showing, you know, I wasn't a comms guru. I wasn't raising money. I wasn't a policy person. But I did my job as well as I could. And I think at the end of the day, Barack Obama was like, well, who, not to pat myself on the back, but, you know, who could do it better? Who knows us better? Who has proven themselves more? And so I was really, I was honored.
And you were listed eventually as one of Washington's most powerful, least famous people. Is there an advantage to sort of flying under the radar like that?
I think so. You know, I think that my job was to run things. I was in charge of the 18-acre campus. I helped, you know, interview cabinet nominees. I interviewed Jim Comey for his job. And I think that it let me do my job without and serve the president without the pressure of people scrutinizing me. It's like, you know, press is always, there's always upside and always downside. And I felt like, you know, I just kept my head down. I did my work, and I think it worked out for everybody. It wasn't my job to be a public face, and I wasn't trained to be a public face, so I was happy to just be under the radar.
But there is another side to that, too. You were referred to, I can't remember if it's the New York Times or the Washington Post, this job is basically a travel agent, which felt like a real insult to you.
It is an insult. It is an insult because it is, you know, director of scheduling in advance, you are essentially building the brand of whatever person you're working for. You are figuring out with all of the other component parts, all the other departments, how to put your boss out there and get the message and have people, you know, perceive them in the right way. And, you know, especially in the White House, you're working with the military and the Secret Service, and you're a diplomat, basically. You're negotiating with foreign governments during foreign trips. So whoever wrote that certainly had no idea what any of us did.
Well, and it also is not something that would likely be said of a man, is it?
No. No. I mean, I think that, you know, I think if you look at any, I hate to generalize, but I think that women don't promote themselves as much. And I know that even when I was writing this book, the hardest part for me is that I was committed to only telling what I thought was my story and didn't want to tell anybody else's story. You know, I didn't want the book to be, this was Alyssa's place in history. It was more about letting young women know that they could participate in the same way I did.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our conversation with Alyssa Mastromonaco. She's former deputy chief of staff under President Obama from 2011 to 2014. She also served as director of scheduling in advance for Senator Obama when he was running for president and was hired into that same role once he was in the Oval Office. Her new book is called Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers to When You Work in the White House. It's part memoir and part how-to or advice book for young women interested in a career in politics. I asked Alyssa how she came up with the book's title.
The minute that I thought about writing this book, I knew what the title had to be. So who thought this was a good idea was an email that I would often get, or any of the people who worked for me, from the people who were on the road or Barack Obama himself. And usually it was they knew exactly who thought it was a good idea. And it was usually about some sort of event or something that we had put together that he was going to participate in or do that he did not think was a good idea. And so if you ever got the who thought this was a good idea, you knew you were sort of in trouble.
what was your worst ever who thought this was a good idea note?
The worst ever was probably about 2 weeks before the election in 2008. And, you know, we were sort of neck and neck with John McCain. And both Obama and McCain were in Pennsylvania that day. And everybody knows Pennsylvania, you know, is like the battleground. And Barack Obama does not like the cold. I think that most people know that. I'm not revealing any secrets. But it had gotten quite cold in Pennsylvania. And there was a chance of snow. And so we said, well, you know, snow's not that bad. It was an outdoor event he was doing. Came into the office, went to see David Plouffe. I'm like, Plouffe, we got to keep this, right? Like, John McCain's canceling his events. Obama, he's like, yeah, Obama has to do it. And so I send them a note. I say to the road, everybody who's with Obama, I say, hey, guys, we're keeping the Chester, Pennsylvania event. You know, it's outside, but maybe he doesn't work a rope line or something to make the time outside a little shorter. And so as the event kicks off, we see in horror that the snow has turned to sleet and is smacking him in the face, which is basically worst case scenario. And so we just like watched, our eyes were tearing up. We're like, oh my God, this is going to be such a disaster. And so he goes to walk off stage and we see him reach his hand out to Reggie Love. Reggie puts the phone in his hand and within 10 seconds, my phone rang and I could see from caller ID that it was him. And he said, Alyssa? And I said, yes, sir. He said, it's Obama. Oh, my God, the event was great. CNN, MSNBC, they're reporting it exactly, you know, exactly as we said they would. You're like viral. He's like, he cuts me off and he goes, where are you? I said, I'm at my desk. And he goes, must be nice. And hung up. And so that was, and we had earlier in the morning, we had gotten an email from Reggie Love when I wrote and I said, we're keeping the event. And Reggie wrote back and said, who thought that was a good idea?
Uh-huh.
And so, but the punchline sort of to the whole story is that the picture of Barack Obama being smacked in the face with sleet actually won the Pulitzer later that year.
Okay. So it turned out being a good idea.
I thought so.
So he gets elected. You get your job at the White House transition team. And then in the White House, it's a lot to learn there in a very short time. Was the outgoing Bush administration, were they helpful to you and your team?
And this is part of so much of what sort of hurts my gut in what's happening currently. But the Bush people could not have been more generous, more thoughtful. A story that I love so much. They hosted us several times at the White House before they left. And it was a few days before Christmas. And I got an email and they said, oh, we want to do one more meeting. So my deputy, Danielle, and I, we walk to the White House and we go to the gate to the EEOB, the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, where the meetings usually took place. And the security guard said, you know, actually, your meeting's in the West Wing. And we said, no, it's not. And they said, no, it is, ma'am. Can you please go to the other guard? And finally, they were like, leave, like, go to the other kiosk. And so we go and they check us in. And Danielle and I were so nervous. I've never been in the West Wing before, that we held hands the entire way down to the guards, to the Marines that opened the doors to the West Wing. And we're sitting in the lobby and we're waiting. And lo and behold, Josh Bolton's assistant comes out to get us. And he wanted to have a meeting with us. He wanted to welcome us. And he said, when you get to the White House, because as I said, it was right before Christmas, so when you get to the White House, Christmas will be the busiest time of year and you will never enjoy it. And we wanted to make sure that you enjoyed it. And they gave us a personal guided tour of all the holiday decorations and all the rooms that they use and of the East Wing. And then they took us to the Oval Office, which neither of us had ever been in before. And we both got really teary-eyed and we were just so nervous and we're like still holding hands. And they said, no, you can go in. I mean, like, they could not have been more wonderful. They left us written instructions. They left us letters in our desks. They left us binders of templates. I mean, honestly, it was a real lesson in what the transition of power is and should look like.
Wow.
And we promised, even in 2012, when I was deputy chief, and Obama was running against Mitt Romney, We still did the same thing. We updated all of our binders in case, you know, in case we didn't win. And we started working with the Romney people on their security clearances just to make sure, because that's what you do.
Well, so what are you observing now that hurts your gut about the transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration?
You know, I think that part of what hurts me is they've painted everything with one brush. And it's not about politics, because, like, you know, as I said earlier, we know it's a pendulum. I'm not naive. Of course, you know, if a Republican won, they were going to come in and they'd have their own policies. But for me, it's more about the sort of weirdly, you know, destructive attitude towards the federal government, the career employees who maintain and who help with the continuity of, you know, government from administration to administration, being cast as like Obama people when chances are they've been around since like Reagan or Bush or Clinton. And I think that it is almost to me as if they are killing Obama initiatives and anything that they believe was associated with us, like for sport, instead of actually learning why some of the things were important. And especially as you see, like, you know, they think that the protocols are silly. You know, I've heard them say in the press, oh, you know, we're doing things differently. Well, there's a reason that you use the Rose Garden for certain events, or that when you would see Barack Obama in the cross hall of the East Room, that you knew he was going to say something important. It's all part of sending a message. You know, it can't just be like arbitrary. And, you know, and they'll see when they go on foreign trips that protocols aren't meant to constrain you. They're actually meant to make people feel comfortable so they know how to act in certain situations.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Mastromonaco about her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Well, this was a lot that you learned at the beginning of scheduling in advance, and you were then promoted to deputy chief of staff, a really high-stress job. And you're candid about that, how it was working at the White House. Very pragmatic. You managed all this with irritable bowel syndrome. I don't know how you did it. And then you left the White House in 2014. How did you know it was time to leave?
So I knew it was time to leave. I think that, you know, all of us who work for Barack Obama, he commands, like, you're just so loyal. We were all so loyal to him. And part of my, you know, deep in my core, I just always wanted to be giving 120%. And I think that, you know, basically for all those years, starting at the very beginning of the campaign in early 07, you're basically running off of adrenaline. And it started to just take its toll. I was exhausted. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't my best self, you know, and it's in I think it was 2004, 2005. There was this documentary that came out called The September Issue, and it's
About Vogue magazine, Anna Wintour.
Yes, yeah. Anna Wintour. And she says that when she talks about her father leaving the Evening Star, he said he knew it was time to go when he was angry. And I hadn't quite, but I always remembered that. And I hadn't quite gotten to angry, but I wasn't my best self. And I also felt that I had really experienced so much that someone else deserved to have the opportunity. You know, like, could I have ridden it out to the end? Probably. But I had a great time. It was a wonderful experience. And I wanted to go out on a high note, too. You know, some people just stay too long. and I'm glad, because the woman who replaced me, she had been around since, you know, the Senate campaign also in 2004. And, you know, I never regretted the decision I made for all those reasons.
Well, you obviously learned a lot. What do you think your advice would be to a young woman who says, you know, I want to work in politics, public service, and I'd love to work at the White House eventually?
I would say that, one, you know, worm's eye view. It's like, if I hadn't have had an internship, I never would have known what really drew me to politics. And so I think that being in politics, and of course there's a difference between politics and government and public service, but I think that you have to be in it for the right reasons. And I think if you're in it to just, you know, gain power, that it'll be a more treacherous ride. But I would encourage women to get involved as early, you know, as possible, you know, in your high school, in your community, you know, volunteer for a city councilor or a state representative, you know, volunteer after hours, get an internship. I think that in as much as is possible, it doesn't take, you know, doing it every day after school, but, you know, a couple days a month, get out there and see what it's all about. And I think that when people see the dedication, you really get picked up. People notice it. And so that's what I would tell them to do.
Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for that. Really appreciate speaking with you.
Thank you.
Alyssa Mastromonaco, she's now president of global communications at A&E Networks and liaison to Viceland. And she's author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. You'll find more information on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The cover alone is worth looking at. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We are a nation divided on politics, ideology, and the nature of facts. We seek out friends and news sources that affirm our vision of the world and demonize those who disagree. It is distancing, sure, but Elizabeth Lesser says it's dangerous.
The worst eras in human history, whether in Cambodia or Germany, or Rwanda, they start like this with negative otherizing, and then they morph into violent extremism.
That is a clip from Take the Other to Lunch, a TED Talk announcing Lesser's initiative to open up dialogue between people who disagree with each other over lunch. The talk has been shared or heard by more than a million people. And though she is no expert on conflict resolution or civic conversations, she has been lunching with others since 2010. She's a founder of the Omega Institute and Omega Women's Leadership Center, and a New York Times best-selling author, most recently of the memoir Marrow, A Love Story. Elizabeth Lesser, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me. So happy to be with you.
Elizabeth, you are not an expert in conflict resolution. So why do this?
Well, as you heard in that clip from my TED Talk, I, and I'm sure so many of us, especially today after the contentious election that we just went through, we're concerned about what's going on in our country. You know, so many of us think of ourselves as open-minded, people who would never call ourselves bigoted, and we work for all sorts of social justice issues and have friends from all different races and sexual orientations. But you know, when it comes to how we feel about, how we relate to or don't relate to people from other ideologies, almost all of us could be called bigoted because we have such strong opinions based on news and what we think and assumptions about other people who voted differently, have different ideologies than we do. And it's a dangerous thing when a country or a society or a community devolves into such a sense of separation that people are no longer talking to each other but just about each other. And we've seen what it happens in history. You don't have to be a historian to understand what happens when huge swaths of a population don't trust each other, don't like each other, and don't know each other.
So your idea is to take the other to lunch, to move through that caricature, that demonization or dehumanization, as you call it, of other people. How do you identify people that you want to invite to lunch?
Well, I'll tell you first how I came up with the idea. I didn't just like wake up one morning and say, hey, I think I'll take someone from the Tea Party to lunch or something like that. I am one of the founders of Omega Institute, and we have conferences about all sorts of subjects all the time. And about 8 or 9 years ago, I was putting a conference together that I called Women and Power. I was asking the question, do women do power differently? And I invited all these interesting women leaders, and I invited most of the living Nobel Peace Prize winners who were women. But I thought, you know what would really stretch us as women who are asking this question, do we do power differently? Are we more inclusive? Can we listen to each other better? What if I brought together some women from both sides of the abortion debate, and women who have actually learned to work together and stop otherizing each other and dehumanizing each other. And I found this group of women who had come together from both sides of that debate after a killing in Boston at an abortion center. And they felt, you know what, we're contributing to violence by demonizing each other as leaders in the pro-life and pro-choice movement. Could we model for our community that we can love each other and still have a different point of view about a hot topic? So they started meeting secretly, and they got to know each other, and they got to like each other, and they started going to each other's kids, like First Communion or Bat Mitzvah or marriage, and they became friends. Nobody changed anyone's mind. They still kept working in their fields, but they respected each other. So I invited them to the conference as well, and they did something on the stage together. And I was kind of shocked that many people in the audience got what I was trying to do, but others thought, how dare you bring someone from a point of view that I disagree with? You're legitimizing something I disagree with. And that's when I got the idea, like, yeah, it's really inspiring to listen to Nobel Peace Prize winners, but can we be Nobel Peace Prize people in our own communities? Can we make peace with people we disagree with? Isn't that what we respect in the Dr. Kings of the world, the Mother Teresas of the world? Can we be that? So that's why I started this initiative, even though it was just me doing it and then writing about it and encouraging other people to do it, where you identify a person, maybe at work, or maybe it's your brother-in-law who doesn't believe in climate change, or maybe it's a pastor down the road who won't marry gay people. Someone who you disagree with, but also someone who's open enough to want to talk across difference to see if there can be some kind of humanizing of each other. And then I have a whole set of guidelines, and you can find those guidelines through my TED Talk or on my website, of how to invite and what to do once you're together. With the goal of just getting out of assumptions about each other and becoming human together.
Well, I wonder about that, because I have mentioned this to a couple of people, and they say, I don't want to have lunch with the other side. I don't want to talk to these people. So how do you encourage people to walk across that burning bridge? You know, because it is an uncomfortable, or they expect an uncomfortable conversation. What has it been for you?
Well, uncomfortable is a good word, but discomfort is never a reason not to go for the healing. The healing bridge is often very uncomfortable. We have to confront our own assumptions. We have to confront our own knee-jerk reactivity. And we have to stay open and big enough to let the other in to our heart. This isn't something we're used to doing. We can barely do it with our wife or husband or kid or neighbor or best friend or that jerk colleague at work. You know, it's hard for us human beings to get out of our own point of view and open toward the other. That's one of the reasons I have found it so interesting to combine things like meditation or other kinds of practices that put down the judging mind for a minute, enough time to let something else bubble up into your brain, because this is not the typical human behavior to reach across difference to the other. Now, you can't make someone do it. If you have the kind of friend who's like, I will never talk to someone from the other side, well, you can't make them do it. All you can do is model what it's done for you to talk positively about how it feels to get out of the fear space, to get out of the judgmental and the hyper-vigilant state, to kind of put some of that down for a while and open and merge with the humanness of another person. You can just throw little tidbits like that out, speaking personally as opposed to preaching, which won't work.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Lesser about her Take the Other to Lunch initiative. It is the subject of a TED Talk that many, many people have seen, and something that she's been practicing herself for, I guess, going on 7 years now, taking somebody who is ideologically opposed just out for lunch. Elizabeth, some of the guidelines you set down are, don't try and persuade another person. Be curious, you know, be conversational, be real.
So what do you talk about if you don't talk about the differences?
Well, of course, eventually you do talk about the differences, but that's not how I generally start. And let me just also say there's a lot of people doing this now, and there's some fantastic guidelines you can find online. One of my favorite organizations is called The Living Room Conversations. There's also a wonderful new website called Hi from the Other Side. And this is for people who don't really want to actually sit down person to person with someone at lunch or in your living room. And this is a way to kind of find an email buddy that from the other side. This is a response right now all over the country. It's not just a few kind of like Pollyanna people who want to make nicey-nice. People are beginning to wake up to the fact that, hey, our leaders are not going to do this for us. We have to do it. In fact, leaders often enjoy discord between the people because it's a way to build their base around anger and division. And I actually think it's a revolutionary act. As much as it is to march or to mobilize voting, it's a revolutionary act to reach out to someone else. So how do you do it? What do you say over lunch? You start with questions like, how does it feel to be you? What do you feel and what brings you to your point of view? Let's say you're talking about climate change, someone who doesn't believe in it. Well, why do you feel this way? What's going on in your life? What is your relationship to business, to nature, to your family, to your place? And you get to know each other's lives, your problems, your struggles. And as you become more and more human together, you can talk about a hot issue with less attack and less judgment and more of a sense of understanding on how someone has come to the opinion they've come to.
Well, if you are having lunch with somebody who, as one of your barriers goes, makes smoke come from your ears, how do you keep yourself from taking that bait, from lunging in, from telling them what you think and why they're wrong?
That's probably the most important question. I love that question because we all take the bait. We take the bait every day in little and big ways. It's I call it going into the basement brain. We all have part of our brain that is in the fight or flight mode really all the time, like either I'm going to lash out and be defensive or I'm going to run away because I can't defend myself. And most of the time, that fight or flight reaction, that basement brain reaction, is really inappropriate because most of the time we're not really under that kind of immediate threat that our brain was built for, you know, for when we had to escape from a tiger attacking us. And that's why I have found in my own life, for this kind of work, but just for being a mate and being a colleague, that meditation and other kinds of psychotherapeutic or spiritual, quote-unquote, practices are really, really helpful ways of taming that fight or flight instinct in us. So I would say it's really good to prepare yourself in these situations to learn how to be a little less defensive, a little less reactive, a little less assuming that the other person is out to get you, so that you can show up with an open heart, but also a strong backbone, so you don't get taken advantage of.
You know, I've read a lot of criticisms about finding, quote, common ground, that if we have this drive to find out where people connect, it is an oversimplification, that it obscures some of the deeper questions and forces this idea of we can all get along over points we can agree on rather than that we can disagree and be okay. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's very easy to oversimplify this and make it just sound all nice with like smiley faces and flower stickers. And it's not easy. It's not simple. And I just want to say a couple of things about that because it's really important to bring this up. One is that if you go into a conversation like this with the expectation that you're going to clean everything up over one lunch and you're going to solve it and come to some common ground, you're going to be disappointed. The purpose of this is not to change anyone's mind, and it's not even to find resolution. The purpose is a strategy that says, if we are connected to each other as human beings, we are less likely to devolve into national chaos and what can come from that. And I think it's as important to keep civility alive between different groups of people as it is to run for office, as it is to march in the streets, as it is to write an op-ed piece. For two people from different sides of the aisle, of the issues, to find a sense of shared humanity is a powerful act. And if everyone was doing that, we'd be in a different state of mind in our country.
Elizabeth Lesser, she's founder of the Omega Institute and Omega Women's Leadership Center, a best-selling author, and the person who came up with Take the Other to Lunch. Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we'd love to hear from you. What about you? Are you willing to have lunch with the other? We would love to hear from you, and we would love to follow up on your progress. Go to our website for more, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came from Poddington Bear, Persona La Ave, and Delay. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Alyssa Mastromonaco, Deputy Chief of Staff for President Obama. Well, she also joined us with an insider's view of the Oval Office, traveling on Air Force One, and state visits for our Civics 101 podcast. You can listen at civics101podcast.org or on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Virginia Prescott. We will be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.